We're gonna get started now. Thank you all for coming out to Blue Stockings tonight. I wrote something up because this is a big deal for me, so bear with me. My name is Kimmy David. I am one of the collective members here at Blue Stockings. We are incredibly honored and humbled to welcome Grace Lee Boggs and Scott Kurashiga and all of you here to our space tonight. We are a collectively owned and operated feminist bookstore, movement center, activist space that is powered by over 70 volunteers every week. We have been here for nearly 12 years, and we hope to be here for our communities for much, much longer. Thank you. It's really through the support of all of you who come and buy books here, attend our events, and volunteer that, you know, helps keep our doors open. That said, we ask for a suggested donation of $5 for all of our events, or whatever feels right to you to give. If you have more, please donate. If not, you know, please give what you can. I'm gonna pass that jar around. So, growing up the daughter of Filipino immigrants in Queens, it really was a struggle for me to find role models that not only, you know, people whose lives and work that I could get down with and appreciate, but also people who fit into my view of race, class, and gender. And then I found Grace, which was a total game changer, and she actually just told me that she went to high school in my neighborhood, so now I'm like even more in love. Dr. Grace Lee Boggs was born to Chinese immigrant parents in 1915 and is an activist, writer, and speaker whose 70 years of political involvement encompasses the major U.S. social movements of the 20th century. In Detroit, Grace and the Boggs Center to Nurture Community Leadership continues the grassroots work that she and her husband, James Boggs, an African-American auto worker, activist, and writer, partnered in for 40 years until his death in 1993. Grace's newest book, available here, and don't we all wish we were 95 and writing books, that's so awesome, it's called The Next American Revolution, Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century, which was co-written with Scott Kurashiga, a professor at the University of Michigan's Department of American Culture. Both of them will be signing books here at the end of the event, so please pick up a copy, and please join me in welcoming Grace and Scott. Thank you.
Hi.
It's working? Okay, great.
Thank you.
It was a test.
Okay. Hello. Hello.
Okay.
Thank you. Should we switch? Maybe we should switch.
Try it again.
That's craziness.
Okay.
There you go.
Hey. Thank you all for coming out tonight. It's absolutely wonderful to be in New York, and it's absolutely wonderful to be in this incredible space. It's my first time here, and I'd love to keep coming back here. It's just nice to see bookstores anywhere these days. We've had some incredible events at NYU and the Brecht Forum in the past two nights. Some of you were there. Thank you for coming. Thank you to the Blue Stockings Collective for selling books at those events as well. But it just feels really nice to be around all these books and people. So thank you to Blue Stockings, and thank you all for coming out. It's wonderful to be in an independent bookstore. And it's the perfect setting for this book, because this book is definitely an anti-capitalist project. And an anti-capitalist production. We're on a non-commercial educational press, and all of the proceeds from this book are going back into the struggle in Detroit.
You're here.
So yeah, we're not taking a paycheck for this. It's all going back, including the royalties. And I want to say a little bit about that struggle that's going on in Detroit, because I'm sure you hear things in the media, in the newspaper, and word of mouth, but it never hurts to reinforce some of the really, really, I think, tragic things that are happening, sense of that, but also at the same time, the things that give us hope as well. So recently, the state of Michigan passed a law which allows for the governor, who right now is a man by the name of Rick Snyder. His platform when he ran was, "I am one tough nerd." So basically, he's a smiling, nice version of Scott Walker in Wisconsin. And the state of Michigan has passed an emergency manager law, which allows the Republican governor to simply designate someone to be in charge of school systems or cities who's unelected and who's basically not accountable to any of the voters. Okay, so this law has already been used just in the past couple days in Benton Harbor, which is a city on the western side of Michigan, a historic African-American population, a lot of economic challenges as in Detroit. And what this does is it basically gives this appointed manager the power to simply tear up all contracts with public officials, to hire and fire people at will, and to make decisions that are completely beyond the purview of any elected officials. So the elected officials, according to the Detroit News, under this new measure, can only call meetings to order, adjourn them, and approve minutes. They're sort of basically like the Boy Scouts of City Hall now. So that's what's happening. We're seeing, on the one hand, literally the elimination of any semblance of representative democracy. In the Detroit public school system, which I'm sure some of you have heard about, yesterday, one of these emergency financial managers, a man by the name of Robert Bob, appointed from outside of Detroit, came from Washington, D.C., laid off every teacher in the entire school district. So over 5,000 teachers were laid off yesterday. Now, some of them will eventually be hired back, we hope, but many of them won't. And again, this is an opportunity for these unelected, unaccountable officials to impose their will upon the people, the students, the workers, in whatever manner they choose, at the whim and service of the governor. There was an order to close nearly half of the schools in the district that also came from the state. To try to avoid that, what they're trying to do instead is close some of the schools and turn all the rest of the schools into charter schools between now and the start of the school year. And if they can't turn them into charter schools, if they can't get someone to agree to do that within the next month, then they're going to shut down most of those schools. And this is on top of the fact that half of the schools have already been closed in the time that I've lived in Detroit over the past 7-8 years. Just today, there was another story that came out. There are 23 branches left of the library, the public library system in Detroit, some real jewels in that system. And the library is now saying that 12 to 18 of these 23 branches will close. And it's really gotten to the point where the city is talking about, the mayor is talking about, is in essence closing neighborhoods. Because if you don't have a school, if you don't have a library, if they're saying we're not going to pick up your trash more than, you know, once or twice a month, we're not going to turn the lights on all the time, and they're basically telling you, you know, you're on your own. So this is where we are in terms of disaster capitalism, as Naomi Klein calls it, the shock doctrine, or neoliberal austerity measures. Detroit is in many ways the canary in the coal mine, giving us a sense of what's to come for everybody else if this system of undemocratic rule continues. And it really brings to mind Martin Luther King's call for a revolution of values against the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and materialism. King said that America is going to hell, and that a nation that continues to spend more on waging wars than uplifting its people will suffer a spiritual death. Okay. So this is the crisis we face. There is, however, another side to this. As Grace's partner Jimmy Boggs used to say, we learned under the conditions of white supremacy and Jim Crow in the rural South to make a way out of no way. And this is what Detroit is showing the rest of the nation and the world. The possibility to make a new way out of what appears to be no way. And so there's a school in Detroit called the Katherine Ferguson Academy, and we talk about it in the book. because it's really a model of creativity and imagination in the midst of despair and abandonment. It's a school in one of the most devastated neighborhoods in the city. The blocks around it have maybe one or two houses on each block in many instances, because 38% of the land and structures in Detroit are now deemed to be vacant. But what they've done, and it's a school for teenage mothers and pregnant girls, who many of you know have the highest rates of dropout among all students. And it has an imaginative curriculum that tends to their needs to nurture life, to take care of their children. And along with that concept, what they've done is they've torn up their entire concrete playground and put in an urban farm, not just with plants and produce and bees and fruit trees, but also with cows and chickens and goats. And they've got an imaginative science teacher that had them build a big red barn as part of their science project. So it's a hands-on, practical form of learning, like Grace talks about. And it's attracted attention from all over the world, from people working with the Nobel Institute. There's been several documentary films that have focused on Katherine Ferguson Academy. They've been featured in the New York Times and every other publication you can imagine in Detroit and around the world. And they've really become this shining symbol for so many people we've brought through Detroit of the possibility to make the world anew, as Grace talks about, to make a way out of no way. And this school is now on the list of schools projected to close if they don't find within 1 month a charter system to come in and replace the entire administration and somehow take over the whole school, as if that can be done effectively, you know, between now and the start of the next school year. So some of the girls held a sit-in, and they attracted lots of attention in the media, and they were all dragged out of the school and arrested. So this is a challenge we're facing in Detroit. And this is why people really should be focusing and following the things that are going on. And this is why we're so fortunate to have guiding us and leading us and helping us to think through these problems someone with 70 years of experience, someone whose first sense of political analysis was forged during the Great Depression, Grace Lee Boggs. And so I just want to do a brief introduction of Grace, and because I'm in a bookstore, I just feel like I want to read some of the books. I've never done this before. Few of us will be lucky to live to 95 years of age with any faculties, let alone the full and vigorous abilities with which Grace Lee Boggs continues to approach her political and intellectual life. We need to appreciate how the personal and political identifications that consign Grace to the margins of 20th century politics, being a woman, being the daughter of Chinese immigrants, being a radical, being a philosopher activist, how these things that consign Grace to the margins of the 20th century now uniquely position her to speak to the dilemmas of 21st century America. But as Jimmy Boggs, Grace's life partner, intellectual collaborator, and political comrade for 40 years, was wont to say, just coming out of your mother's womb does not make you a human being. Jimmy Boggs urged us to recognize the role creative thinking and responsible action play in advancing humanity. To understand what Grace represents to us today, we might add, just getting old doesn't make you wise. As she recounts in this book, Grace had the great fortune to be not just a witness, but also an active participant in the humanity-stretching movements of the 20th century. Her close associates have included people who changed the course of history, such as the legendary actors Ruby Dee, who joined us yesterday, and Ossie Davis, the Pan-Africanist and Ghanaian President Kwame Nkrumah, and the pioneering Black Marxist C.L.R. James. Grace once met in New York with Malcolm X to propose that he join the revolutionary activities she was undertaking with other Black Power activists in Detroit. He said he had other things he had to do at that time, and of course we know his time was very short. Still, the most formidable figure in her life has undoubtedly been Jimmy Boggs, and Grace may say more about that partnership. If it is possible to pinpoint one characteristic that distinguishes Grace and really her partnership with Jimmy, it is that she embodies the unity of theory and practice in a manner that has become increasingly rare. In the U.S., we have a disturbing tendency to reduce the production of ideas and knowledge to academics. I know I'm around a lot of these academics, much more than I need to be. Americans go to school for a finite period of time to learn things, and then we go out into the so-called real world to put what we have learned into practice. And many U.S. activists are too quick to view intellectual work as the domain of those with academic jobs, deeming it elitist in general, and too prone to discount the role creative thinking plays in movement building. To this brand of activists, signs of inequality and injustice are obvious, and all you have to do is thus protest the status quo and demand the redistribution of resources and power. By contrast, Grace has continued to devote much of her time to study and reflection, even as she has parted ways with the academic world for a life of organizing and movement building. Reflecting her belief in the power of ideas, books and publications can be found stacked and stacked from the floor to ceiling in every room of her modest flat. And over the past decade, she has spent an increasing amount of time surfing the best writings and videos on the web. Unlike those radicals devoted almost exclusively to action in pursuit of an old truth they discovered during their political awakening, Grace is constantly seeking to make sense of new developments and conditions, tracking changes both within the dominant culture and the forces of resistance. This behavior is consistent with her imperative to think dialectically. Remember those two words. A maxim drawn from her study of the philosopher Hegel. Because reality is constantly changing, we must constantly detect and analyze the emerging contradictions that are driving this change. And if reality is changing around us, we cannot expect good ideas to hatch within an ivory tower. They instead emerge and develop through daily life and struggle, through collective study and debate among diverse entities, and through trial and error within multiple contexts. Grace often attributes her having been born female and Chinese to her sense of being an outsider to mainstream society. Over the past decade, she has sharpened this analysis considerably. Reflecting on the limits of her prior encounters with radicalism, Grace fully embraces the feminist critique, not only of gender discrimination and inequality, but also of the masculinist tendencies that too often come to define a certain brand of movement organizing, one driven by militant posturing, a charismatic form of hierarchical leadership, and a static notion of power seen as a scarce commodity to be acquired and possessed rather than shared. But though Grace has been associated with historical figures and has dined with luminaries on more than one occasion, her daily activities are primarily occupied by meetings and communications with people working at a grassroots level to transform blocks, neighborhoods, and cities. These new and renewing relationships with people and ideas particularly feed Grace's creative spirit and nourish her soul. For every narrative of individuals or movements shared face-to-face, by email, or through written publications, brings with it the new lessons in life and struggle, new reasons to believe that humankind can achieve that which must still be accomplished. Be they artists or statesmen, shopkeepers or grandparents, elders are rightly concerned with their legacy. And Grace is concerned about hers. But she still bristles with the energy of a 25-year-old movement activist, and this is readily apparent to everyone who crosses her path. I should say, the reason I co-authored this book with Grace is not because she's retired, because she doesn't write anymore, because, you know, she doesn't have the energy to do this. She's actually too busy to sit down and finish a book, and I'm fortunate that I get paid to write books still. It's part of my job. So Grace still bristles with the energy of a 25-year-old movement activist. And as a result, this book draws lessons and meaning from the past, but it is clearly focused on the present and future. A present and future that you all, by joining us today, are now a part of. So please join me in welcoming Grace Leibach.
Wonderful introduction. Thank you, Scott. You know, Scott is the one who conceived this book, who selected the materials, who organized the chapters, and who made all the arrangements for the publishers. So I owe him a lot, and we all owe him a lot. Thank you, Scott. I want to thank all of you who have come here tonight, particularly those who have come all the way from Philadelphia, and my old friend Rosa Lepastic, who was in the first revolutionary study group on the book Revolution, Evolution in the 20th Century, way back in the 1970s. It's very interesting to be here tonight. I read about Blue Stockings in the book Whirlwinds of Change and was anxious to come here. I didn't really know that it was in the middle of Chinatown. I don't know if folks know, I'm a New Yorker. I don't feel like one at this moment, but I grew up in New York, in Jackson Heights. I went to college at Barnard College. I spent 10 years here from 1943 to 1953 working with C.L.R. James and working on Marx and Lenin and Hegel. And I've only been in Detroit for the last nearly 60 years. Most of that time in the same house. Someone once asked me, what do I think is the most important thing that I've done? And I think it is living in the same house, in the same city, for so long. In this age when so many of us are so mobile, and where it's so difficult to get an impression of how change is taking place. You know, when you're in the same place, other things happen and you get an idea of history unfolding. Here in New York, when I was growing up, there were so few Asians that we were almost invisible. And I come here to New York now, and all over the country, Asians are the fastest growing minority ethnic group. And that gives us, who are Asian American, I think, a very special role at this time. I met this afternoon with two people from CAF, and I asked them, how do they see their role in relationship to what's happening in Asia, to the meltdown in Japan, to the polluted skies above Beijing and Shanghai? Do we in America, not only Asian Americans, but all Americans, have a special role to play in relationship to what's taking place there? Can we reflect on our experience and talk about our experiences in such a way as to help others of the world understand that the next American Revolution is something that not only America needs, but the world needs. That all of us have to begin to live more simply so that others can simply live. And so I think that we ought to, in this next period, be thinking a lot about how the next American Revolution is, with the effect that it's going to have on revolutions, say, across the Middle East and North Africa, and what's happening in Asia. It's not, I mean, our role, having been so destructive of other peoples, of other countries, and of the earth, and having learned that lesson, and realize that we have to begin transforming ourselves, and that the next American Revolution consists not of getting more things, but of transforming not only our institutions, but who we are. That we have to begin making a radical revolution of values. We have to begin changing ourselves, and that is the nature of 21st century revolutions. A revolution in which we all have a role to play, not only in this country, but in terms of how what we do in this country can be an example of to the rest of the world of what can be done to continue the evolution of humanity and to maintain life on all living things on this planet. It's a hell of a time to be alive, but it's a wonderful time. I think to understand that the time that we are at on the clock of the world is one of the most remarkable times that any society, any people have ever experienced. That this is not only that the dying of the empire, that the meltdown in Japan, that the climate crisis that we face are not only dangers but opportunities to create the world anew. And that, as the first chapter of the book says, these are the times to grow our souls. I know most of you flinch at using the word soul, but I think we have to begin using it proudly. Recognize that it is a power to make choices, that it is a power to create the world anew. And that despite all the efforts of global capitalism to commodify us and all our relationships, to commodify our environment, to turn us into things, we have the power within us to create the world anew. Just say that and say, we have the power within us to create the world anew. And that this is the time to grow our souls. And the soul is not a thing, but it's the power to make choices. It's the power to make a radical revolution of values. It's the power to transform ourselves and our relationships with one another. You know, for most people, Detroit was once the national and the international symbol of the miracles of industrialization. And then it became the national and international symbol of the devastation of deindustrialization. And that's the picture that most of you have in your mind of abandoned houses and vacant lots. But, you know, people are coming from all over the world these days to make films, to take pictures of how these vacant lots have created the space and the place for us to begin anew. That people in Detroit have looked at the vacant lots not just as blight, but as space where we can grow food, where we can bring the neighbor back into the hood, where we can stop being alienated from one another, where we can create what Martin Luther King called beloved community. To live in a city and look out the window each day and see a vacant lot, to see an abandoned house, and say, that is not the end. That is opportunity to begin anew. So I wish you'd think about that, you know. It's one of the things that I talk about very often is that in my first year of graduate school, I studied Hegel. And Hegel had been a young man at the beginning of the French Revolution, and he danced around the Tree of Liberty. And then he had experienced all the contradictions that emerged out of the French Revolution, the dictatorship of Napoleon, the wars. But he said, we do not get to the absolute like a shot out of a pistol. We have to undergo the labor, the patience, and the suffering of the negative. And I think that we have the opportunity now to experience the negative and to know that out of the negative we have the power within us to create new positives. And that's the experience of Detroit. That's why people come there. They come there. The BBC came there last year to make a film. I don't know how many have seen it. It was broadcast. It was called Requiem. And when they finally produced the film, they had a question mark at the beginning and a question mark at the end. Is it recreation or is it Renaissance? Because we're at a time when actually we are undergoing cultural changes as widespread as those from hunting and gathering 11,000 years ago to agriculture. and from agriculture a few hundred years ago to capitalism, to industry. And so many things are changing under those circumstances. Instead of labor, which people do only to get paid, we have to reimagine work. I think something that people do in agriculture, that we carry on, that we have the capacity to carry on, not only to produce goods and services, but to work with one another and to develop our skills. We don't have to just be interested in the product and the abundance and experience the fragmentation of mass production in order to achieve abundance. The end of jobs, as we've known them, the end of the opportunity to get paid well for your work and paid highly and live middle class lives, is actually an opportunity to experience the joys of work, the humanity expanding capacities of work as contrasted with labor. I mean, it's a fantastic transition we're undergoing, and to be part of it is an opportunity. To be part of it is such a great opportunity. So it's not activism in the old sense of radical activism, where you're protesting against injustice and you want to get down with capitalism, denouncing capitalism and capitalism. It's the opportunity to begin the world anew, to reimagine all the most basic human activities, education, work, relationships, love, everything that has been so commodified, so turned into economics, so fragmented by the lives that we've been living under capitalism. It's the opportunity to live anew, to create anew. So I'm going to stop there and ask folks to ask me questions so that I can respond.
In terms of education, what would you recommend we reimagine or rethink?
Well, I think everyone knows that education is a terrible crisis, and that we can't expect too much from the White House, from Arne Duncan, or from Obama. I think the thing we have to do is understand that our system of education was created only about 100 years ago. And that the idea of going to school and learning within four walls and being apart and separate from the community is a very new idea. And that our kids have already walked away from it. We have such a huge prison population because the dropout rate from schools and the kids don't think that makes no sense at all. That you go to schools now to get information, which you regurgitate when there's information all over us, all around us, and that the idea of seeing kids as a problem, which is the way our education system needs, as people with a deficit, that we are, the schools are going to, overcome, to see kids as having the possibility of becoming the solution instead of being a problem. To understand that children, like every human being, have the need to be of use. And that we have not given them that opportunity, that we have expected them to walk through communities that are broken down, devastated, and not to want to do anything about them. That they are ready to isolate for a full day and for 12, 15 years and not be part of solving these questions. That's a very inhuman way to look at children and a very inhuman way to look at education. And it's no wonder that it's failing. Scott spoke earlier about Katherine Ferguson Academy. It's the school where pregnant mothers, teenagers, instead of dropping out from school, can experience life in school, can begin to grow food, can begin to raise animals, can begin to build bonds, can bring their children to school where there are nurseries for them, so that they don't have to stop life in order to go to school. And that's what we have asked our children to do, to stop living in school and postpone life. For it used to be only 8 years, then it turned to 12, and now it's, you know, people say graduate from school forever. So when there's a chapter in the book that's called A Paradigm Shift in the Concept of Education. So I wish people would think of that phrase, paradigm shift. We're at the point where we need a paradigm shift in our concepts of work, in our concepts of education, in our concepts of community. Everything needs a paradigm shift.
I just forgot to add, this school, the Katherine Ferguson Academy, 90% of the students in that school, 90% of the students in that school graduate. All of them go on to 2-year or 4-year college. They leave there with a sense of empowerment, a sense of hope, a sense of a future. And the school district has said, I'm sorry, but you're a statistic, and we have to balance the budget. I mean, this is the type of revolution of values that we need to confront this type of situation.
Start thinking differently.
Yes.
How would you recommend just closing the gap between the people who are, I guess, non-academic activists and then the people who are actually who are academics in schools who have ideas but maybe might have difficulty kind of connecting with people who are on the street trying to be active in a non-intellectual way? I mean, I don't know. That makes sense.
Well, I think what's happening in Detroit, we are not doing, I mean, Bartlett is not the ones who are doing what's happening. What's happening is that the people in Detroit, that the grassroots, are not waiting for the city council or for the mayor or for the governor or for the president to do things. They wake up and say, I remember when we first started gardening in Detroit, it was when we had established a program called Detroit Summer in order to involve young people in rebuilding and redefining and re-spiriting the city from the ground up. And when we did that, we discovered that there were African-American elders who had been raised in the South who had already begun seeing the vacant lots as opportunities to grow food, and as opportunities to help young people who are raising the cities and have a push-button concept of change to get a sense of patience and understand that change takes time. So we have to recognize what the power that is in with people and acknowledge it and encourage it and nurture it.
In the middle? Yeah. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Hi, my name's Lauren, and I'm really happy that I'm in the same space as you. I have a quick question about opportunities in an environment like New York, because I feel like I'm hearing a lot of people being excited about the political work they're doing in, like, Detroit, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, these really, like, deindustrialized spaces that you're talking about that have space, physical space, to create the world anew. And I feel like New York, the past couple of years, it's just like increasingly commercialized, privatized. There's not like as much space to create the world anew. And oftentimes I feel like some of the things that we get inspired about in other places are like harder to kind of, it's harder to take space here. And that like romanticizing the, you know, deindustrialized space, it's like, it's difficult to kind of figure out where opportunities exist in a place like this. So I was just wondering if you could speak to any opportunities you see for creating the world anew in a place like New York right now.
Well, I hope people will generously put money into those cans that we pass on. Because space is very, very expensive in the city. I don't know what should be done in New York. I have no idea. I know that even though I was raised here, I would find it difficult, and I think it's going to take a lot of imagination to conceive of doing things. There's a little book that was written for 12-year-olds. It's called Seed Folks, and it's written by a guy, I think his name is Philip Fleischman. It's just a tiny book. And it talks about how a little girl looked around the corner from where she lived and saw a very small piece of land. And she decided to plant her garden. And when she decided to plant that garden, an old man, remembering what it was like to grow up in Italy near an agricultural area, joined her. And very shortly, that very little piece of land became a place for a community to emerge. But I think the main thing that we have to do as we think of the future is not try to accomplish too much all at once. You have to start small and start local and do something that moves people and that moves you.
I want to just add a point on this. In the book, we put a lot of emphasis on the need to struggle among ourselves. And we mean that not in the sense of activists who are always fighting over who's going to get the most credit or funding or who has the correct position, but it's a struggle to recognize our own limits, to overcome the contradictions that arise within our own movements, because we can only have movements progress and advance if we struggle against our own limitations and contradictions. And so that's what we mean by talking about sustainable activism, not just sustainability in terms of obviously preventing a disaster from over-commodification and production, but sustainability in terms of movement building. Activism, more and more I see among young people, is seen as either a job. So people try to get the best job they can, they end up working in some nonprofit, which treats them like a cog in a wheel, and then they get burned out. Or people treat activism as something that you have to be so hardcore that you give all of yourself, you know, and you forget about all the ways in which you need to stay healthy with your own body and in your relationships with everyone else. Right? How many children of activists have grown up to be, you know, Republican investment bankers because of that? And so we're talking about the need for activism and politics to be something that's not something external to our lives, but integral to our lives, our neighborhoods, our communities, and our families, right? To make those values of a new way of living, the next American Revolution, central to everything we do. And I think there are different ways in which that can happen in Detroit and in New York. In Detroit, we have to think about housing and childcare and schools because they're disappearing all around us. The capitalist market is moving on to other places. You know, we don't have a single grocery store chain in the entire city of Detroit. We only have about 3 or 4 big box stores in the entire city of Detroit.
That's a blessing.
Even though our population is down 25% since the last census, I think we're still the biggest city in America that doesn't have a Walmart. Woo! And so while Walmart's trying to get in every town, it seems, in America, with at least 3,000 or 4,000 people, they won't come to Detroit, and you guys probably can think about the reasons why. But that's an opportunity, but it's also a challenge for us to have to invent new ways to take care of ourselves, basic things. In New York, you guys are bombarded with all these choices in front of you, all of these consumer capitalist things, and you have to make much more conscious choices to live a different way. And that requires a lot of persistence, a lot of energy, a lot of creativity. And, you know, I think it is happening in certain places. We see the craft movement arising in certain places, you know, organic gardening growing. But I think, you know, we're trying to provide a certain type of model, and you guys have other struggles that you have to hopefully find some symbiosis with ours. Yeah, in the back. Can you talk really loud, and I'll try to repeat it for Grace too.
I'm just curious as to what your opinion is on the role of networks and forming networks and kind of facilitating networks within a community. Maybe you could speak to that, kind of like the importance of that, or the critical nature of how that can affect change.
How do we build networks within a community? How important is it to have those types of relationships?
Well, it seems to me that networks are all over the place. I mean, the people are connecting. I mean, there's an e-learning group. A guy by the name, I forget his name now, in Canada.
George Simons.
George Simons puts out a newsletter about the connectivity of our present period, how much people are creating networks. And I don't think with the technology that we have, I don't think creating networks is our problem, is our challenge.
There is a quote in the book, and it's really one of our favorites. It's from Margaret Wheatley, an author, wrote a book called Leadership and the New Science. She says, the key to social change is not critical mass, it's always critical connections, right? And I think that's part of what you're getting at. It's the quality of the relationships we build, as I said, through families, through neighborhoods, through co-ops, through collectives, sometimes very overtly political in the case of this bookstore, sometimes very much just built around neighbors taking care of each other, right? I think that in many ways sums up what we're talking about as a new vision of thinking about radicalism, not in terms of how militant you are, but the quality of the relationships you build that are already creating the next society while we're still struggling in this one.
Let me emphasize that. Do folks know Margaret Wheatley? Is the name familiar to some of you? Good. Margaret Wheatley is an organizational consultant who's written a wonderful book called Leadership and Modern Science, in which she says, in Newtonian physics, what matters is mass. But when we talk about quantum physics, what matters is connections. And critical connections are critical because they're organic, and even small examples have a connection with the whole. I mean, it's a different way of thinking. If we're always trying to get numbers, we begin thinking in mass terms.
Yeah, you had a hand right there.
Do you think it's possible to have activism within government? And if so, how would that look like?
Can you have activism within government? And if so, what does that look like?
I haven't any idea.
I mean, I think the point we make in the book, and then the Detroit gives an example, but the failures of Washington, D.C. give an example. Representative democracy is basically dead.
Yeah.
Right? It belongs mostly to an age of liberalism in which capitalist nation states were incorporating more workers, and they needed those workers to consume the goods of capitalism. And now they're finding those workers all over the world in other places like China, and they're finding those consumer markets all over the world. So you have hundreds of thousands of people living in places like Detroit, disproportionately poor and African American, who are either being sent off to prisons, who are given no chance to go to decent schools, right? And are basically being discarded. And so, you know, that sense of people needing to have rights and they need to be represented if you're going to have healthy workers and healthy consumers. That's really, that era of liberalism is gone because the whole world has been transformed by globalization, right? So how do we begin to build democracy on the idea of participatory democracy? And in some cases that may involve, you know, changing structures within government in a small way, sometimes in a big way, but it won't only happen through government. It's going to happen largely through changes coming from below, through these grassroots, through those types of networks and connections that we were already talking about.
You talked about a paradigm shift in this talk and other talks before. Can you speak to that in the context of the work people are doing in Detroit, how we perceive crime, punishment, and dealing with the prison industrial complex?
Well, the question is, what would a paradigm shift look like in terms of dealing with crime and the prison industrial complex? It's a good one.
Some years ago, Rosa Napoczek sent me a book called The Aquarian Conspiracy by Marilyn Ferguson. I don't know whether folks know the book or not, but has a wonderful section on paradigm shift. It's only about 10 pages, but they're marvelous to give you an idea. You know, a paradigm shift is like the Copernican Revolution, when we decide that the Earth goes around the sun rather than otherwise. And when something like that happens, a lot of other things change. So I think to incorporate the idea, first of all, paradigm shift is very important, to recognize how many things are involved and how you have to stop thinking in the old way and begin thinking in a new way. Now, what was the question?
So can you talk about the new approach to something like police abuse and imprisonment, not just thinking about bigger demonstrations that are more militant, but we're talking about peace zones for life and restorative justice?
Well, one of the reasons why I think Malcolm is so important is that he was an example of someone who was a petty hustler being transformed into someone who became a leader in the community and continued to transform himself throughout his life. We are experiencing a situation where there are millions of people in prison, contrasted with only a few decades ago. And what is happening, as I see it, is that the example that Malcolm set when he was transformed by his relationship to the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad is taking place with a growing number of young people who are in prison. We have an example in Detroit of a young man by the name of Yusuf Shakur, who never knew his father, but met his father in prison when he was sent to prison himself for a crime that he did not commit, but he could have committed. And his father had, in prison, become a member of the Nation of Islam and had begun to transform himself. And he undertook the transformation of his son when he met him in prison. And Yusuf has written a book called A Window into My Soul, how a thug became a freedom fighter and a father. And I think it's that kind of transformation which we can expect to happen. I think most people don't understand the Nation of Islam. I had the experience, I was very fortunate to have heard Malcolm speak in the 50s. And it's not only that he was very bright and he was very witty, but I noticed how his change of himself helped him to challenge other people to change. You know, how many people have heard Malcolm speak? Probably on DVD, but I don't know where he's been heard him speak in person. Malcolm did not have very large audiences at the beginning of his life. I mean, it's really his career. Because he would make people squirm. He would make them look in the mirror at themselves. And it was a fantastic thing to be part of, to see how uncomfortable people became as they were forced to look at themselves. And I don't think we do enough of that. And when a president asked us, as Jimmy Carter did in 1979, to do that, we say that's, you know, this is a malaise speech, and we don't re-elect him. But I think that's what we have to begin doing, looking at ourselves and understanding how much we have been damaged by our society. how much we have been damaged by the way that we have exploited other people's to advance some middle-class way of life. I don't think we've done enough of that. And that's a very important part of the next American Revolution.
I just want to add in the book, we talk about how Ron Scott, one of Rick Grace's oldest friends, who's been a longtime leader in the Detroit Coalition of Police Brutality, is talking today and is still confronting some horrendous abuses, right? Is talking about how we need not just more militant demonstrations, but we need to create peace zones, create alternative forms of community-driven, nonviolent conflict resolution that's really embedded in the upbringing of every child and neighbor. And it's not easy since there are so many negative influences, and particularly, again, all of these harsh things coming from the state and from the police. But if we're going to, again, not just protest what we don't like, but project alternatives, not just engage in opposition, but in community building, then we need to start developing these visions ourselves. And another thing we talk about is the need for restorative justice. Models that are not just, again, expecting the government to provide jobs or rehabilitation, but models of teaching former offenders to become parts of the community. And that involves them needing to change, and it involves communities needing to change. And these are not easy things to do. This is why we see a new form of radicalism arising from some of these very courageous and groundbreaking activists at the grassroots in Detroit. Lots of other questions. In the middle? Yeah.
You said something earlier about people conceiving a revolution and struggle as their jobs for nonprofits and things like that. I think that New York is a place where we see that happening really ubiquitously. What everybody here in this room, a lot of us just work for different kinds of projects in an environment where there's a really clear call for movement building and some coherence and cooperation amongst all of us. What would you suggest as a model, Grace, for us to ask each other for some more accountability for creating a movement to answer some of the issues that are getting worse in our communities, in our environment, and how are we providing encouragement to each other to really get together? And
that's not a very good question. I'll tell you why not, because it suggests that I might have an answer for a very difficult question, and I don't. I mean, what happened, I think, in the funding of movements and movement activists is that a generation came out of college around the 80s, and so we need a movement, and I want to do that. I want to become a movement activist rather than work for the system. And to do that, I have to live. I have to have a car. I have to pay my rent. And so they were funded. They accepted jobs with nonprofits. And by and large, I would say, in doing so, they lost a sense of what you have to do in order to build a movement. You have to have a lot more patience. You have to be much more a part of the community rather than supported by a nonprofit to do a job within the community. And they didn't develop the proper sense of time. A movement requires time to develop.
Yeah, in the very back? Yeah, right there. Yeah.
Hi. I just had a question about, I think one of the major things that gets in the way of really being able to build community for a lot of urban centers and across the country is the extreme disconnect between generations of people, between our elders and between the youth. There's a fear of youth, and therefore a misunderstanding, a lack of respect for youth, and it's given right back because, you know, everybody wants to be respected and whatnot. And just have disconnections between people when there's even like a 10 or 15 year difference. And I'm wondering, you know, I think that's a very big part of being able to build community and to build the strength of our neighborhoods and to be able to rely on each other and to build trust in each other. And so I'm just wondering if there's anything you guys have been able to do in Detroit to help build some of those connections back between generations you know, as it's gotten lost through this westernized, you know, capitalist structure.
Did you have a question?
I hear it pretty well, but I'm not sure that I can answer it. Because I'm trying to think of the situation that you're in and asking this question. If you come to New York, by and large, you're not going to relate to other people in other generations. You're going to come here as a young person, you're going to live as a young person, you're going to relate to your peers, you're not going to be within the community. And I think one of the reasons why people come to Detroit is because the possibility of being within a community where there are people who have been involved in struggles in the past is much greater. It's very hard to do that here in the city. It takes a lot of time, I imagine. So I don't know how it would be done. I mean, I don't have an answer.
Well, I think one of the things we know, in a market society, elders are looked at as kind of a drag on society. Think of all the talk we're having now about even just all these payments we're going to have to make for Medicare and Social Security. We can't afford it. All these baby boomers are getting old and they're going to be a drag on us. They talk about Japan getting older and even China getting older. And you know, that is very much a part of the modern capitalist world for many, many, many generations, right, of human existence. Elders were seen as a source of wisdom. The older you got, the higher you're standing within the community. And I think, unfortunately, even within movement activism, we have that sense now, right, where, you know, while youth are very important and the energy youth provide is very important, I think Grace provides a model of wisdom that movements need to maintain and hold on to and cherish, and a sense of history. I mean, I think that's important. If younger people at least have an appreciation and need a greater connection to history, then we can start to look at elders in a new way. I think we have a moment now as all of the elders of the civil rights movement generation, right, are at the age in which we really need to capture as many of their stories and narratives and lessons as we can. There's a great project that Vincent Harding and Rachel Harding, two of Grace's old friends, have been working on called the Veterans of Hope Project. So there are other projects like that. Joni Cordova has been doing projects like that. And people can do those both within an academic context and outside of it.
But, you know, let me address this. A lot of students come to the Bog Center. And just the day before we left, there's a program called Semester in Detroit. University of Michigan has students spend a semester in Detroit working with various organizations. And they usually end up there 6 months in Detroit or the semester in Detroit by coming to see me. And I ask them, how many of you are going to go back to your community where you were raised to live? And not a single one plans to do that. They want to come to New York, they want to come to a new city, they want to, you know, come to some place where they have no contacts, no relationships with older people. They've already given up their parents and their grandparents. They don't see that perhaps one of the challenges I put to them is, if you want to make a revolution, your job is probably to help your parents stop being Tea Partiers. And you can do it. But they don't think about it. One of the interesting things about Jimmy is that he was always taking care of old people. And I didn't understand it until I discovered that when one of them died, he'd find another one to take care of. So it wasn't a particular person. He just knew that for him to know who he was, he had to be relating to an older person. And that has been the situation for most of human evolution. And ours is the first generation to accept this tremendous age segregation as natural and normal, and not to recognize the debilitating effects that it has.
Right here.
Well, I just wanted to respond to the last question about this intergenerational gap. I feel like one possible thing is to respect values instead of respecting individuals and or groups of individuals or any distinctions that separate people. But if you have the values inform the relationships, I don't think generational context becomes such an obstacle to actually rallying around those values and producing the outcomes that naturally would manifest themselves in the world from those values. So I just think that's a good consideration, you know.
Thank you for that. We're going to try to take as many as we can, so if you could keep your questions short, and we'll probably try to keep the answers short. So here and then up front, yeah.
Okay. So I had two questions. One was, who are your elders, or who did you look up to when you were, I guess, you know, in your 20s? And then my other question is, like, could you just tell us a story that you find inspiring? Yeah.
Well, I was telling somebody this the other day. When I went to college in the 30s, some of my professors had gone to school in the age of Darwin. Can you imagine that? And I was very lucky. I was lucky that I related to people who had struggled over the idea of evolution. And for most people, that's not a personal thing. That, you know, that's something you might read about in books. It's a concept of some kind. And then I was very lucky when I worked with C.L.R. James, because he was very interested in the French Revolution. And that gave me an opportunity to relate to the 18th century. I'd already begun to relate to the 19th century. And then I began studying the American Revolution. And, you know, as I sort of lived with the people in those periods to get an idea that they were struggling in their period. And it gave me a very different view of history. Most of us have no idea what history is. I often cite a essay written by E.H. Carr, who was the historian of the Russian Revolution. You can find it on the web. It's called What is History? And he says most people think of history as the facts of the past. History is the story of what happened in the past. And it's a story which is told in terms of what you think the future is going to be. Think about history in a very different way. And it's the absence of that understanding of history that I think has made our most radical efforts so ephemeral.
Okay, so there's more inspiring stories in the book. We're going to try to take maybe a series of questions. Please keep them really short, and then we'll see if Grace can address as many of them as possible. So up here first.
Okay. Like, when we discuss movements, we rarely think of our lives, I think, personally, we rarely think of our lives as getting better. Like, when we enter something, sometimes people become cynical, or we think about burnout or things like that. What are some movements currently that when people enter, they become more full, or they build or fruit, like, different possibilities? And, like, how can we make movements, like, when people enter, they become better, or that their lives become more full?
Okay, let's take a couple more. Right there.
Sir. Well, I'm wondering, since so many people are interested in networking, I'm wondering, does she know of a way or a group of people who exist that might be actually like a referral area, so people can actually meet these groups that are actually existing, that have certain types of maybe good standing? And also, is there a clearinghouse for people with ideas? Because I believe that the answers are here. So how do people come to a place to actually share ideas and vet them?
Okay, and there hasn't been a woman question from a woman in a while. Is there a gender balance? Is there any more questions? Okay, yeah, one more.
I was struck a lot by your comments about the relationship between work and labor, and it's you seem to assume that it's kind of a foregone conclusion that the idea of being fairly compensated for your labor, that that's impossible, and that we should embrace that as an opportunity to reimagine work. But there is a labor movement, right, with a kind of like deep and long investment in this idea that people should be fairly compensated for their labor. And as I don't have to say to anybody here, it's under attack right now, and that very idea is under attack. And it has summoned a lot of imagination from people, places like Wisconsin, all over the country, of trying to defend that idea. Would you, given your understanding of work and it being a foregone conclusion, would you say that our energies, I count myself among them, would you say our energies are misplaced in trying to defend this idea? And if so, where should we be putting our energies instead with regard to this issue of labor?
Well, I'm going to ask your question first because it's a little simpler than the others. I think for you and for most people, the labor movement is the movement that emerged after World War II, not the labor movement that emerged in the 30s, right? The labor movement that emerged in the 30s was a movement for the dignity of labor. That was not the movement which Ruther created, with the benefits which came out of earlier World War II. So I think what's happening in Detroit, by the way, is very interesting. We celebrated International Women's Day in Detroit with the women of the UAW. Their initiative was to celebrate what women were doing in the plant, or bring women who were activists in the plant together with women who were creating caring communities. And that is a connection which begins to show us why the labor movement is no longer a movement, why it is on the defensive. Because what is taking place in the community with women is not so much what you get paid for. Most women who are working in their homes, taking care of children and, you know, taking care of families, are not counting the hours that they spend. They're not thinking of compensation by hour or by minute or by overtime. And I think that to understand that Dana Shiva and Maria Meese in a book called Ecofeminism understand that. And I think we need to understand that. And to understand how the labor movement under Ruther turned into an organization for benefits.
So I'm just going to quickly add, obviously the labor movement is very diverse. There have been inspiring moments in history. There are still inspiring things, but one of the things we're talking about is how do we not just defend what was gained in the past, but project a new way for the future. We're also talking about the importance of recognizing that movements that made great breakthroughs in the 30s and the 60s, while we need to know those lessons, we can't simply use those as a blueprint for ongoing or future struggles. And the last thing we're talking about is we need to get beyond the notion of a special American standard of living, right? Because so much of the gains the labor movement were also a product of American empire, they're a product of a military-industrial complex, and they were also really standards for white men in a certain class of jobs that were denied other immigrants, women, people of color in so many ways. And so much of the racism and the materialism, consumerism of the post-war era, which is an era I study a lot in history, was about a privileged class, maintaining a standard of living at the expense of others. So I think, you know, again, important lessons from history, important ongoing struggles, how do we move beyond defensiveness to projecting new ways? The other questions were, how do we
build movements that don't just drain people's energies and make them more angry and cynical and mad, but inspired and yeah. energized. And are there any ways out there for people to discover more of these networks of movement building, if maybe on the web, or how do people find it? Was that kind of what you were getting at?
Things that are already here.
What's already going on? How people...
And also, is there a clearinghouse that I'm sure all over, there are people with answers.
Right.
Is there anything right now where people can go and say, look at this idea, vet it, see what you could use out of it?
If you want to know more about that in Detroit, look up the Detroit City of Hope Network, which Grace and other people from the Bog Center helped to start. You guys probably know more about what's happening locally with that. So, yeah, the question of movements that inspire rather than drain our energy. You want to answer?
Oh, I don't like how-to questions.
So, okay, people ask you this a lot, Grace. So why don't you end with this? Because people often ask you, how have you kept going for so many years? How are you still writing books and starting new organizations and conferences at the age of 95? When I come across 20-year-olds who are like, I'm already a junior in college and I can't keep this up anymore.
Well, I don't mind answering about me, but I think the idea that I can answer it for you, I think is not right. I gain an awful lot from the people around me. It's not me. It's that I am related and connected with so many people who refresh me and invigorate me and inspire me and do things that help me to grow.
So I just want to say a last note. So we've had a great privilege. I've had a great privilege of doing a mini book tour so far with Grace. We've had Danny Glover at a book signing. We've had Robin Kelly, Michael Hart, Mabel Williams, the widow of the great activist Robert F. Williams. I got to sit on the stage yesterday with Amy Goodman and Ruby Dee. But really, as I really want to stress, what Grace is talking about these relationships, it's not just these people who are very famous and prominent and inspiring. It's relationships with people like yourselves who are doing work at the grassroots level, whether it's, again, overt forms of activism or just trying to raise your children or take care of your elders in a more humane way that goes against so much of this system of commodification and profiting and exploitation. So we invite you now to come, and if you have books that you would like Grace to sign, we'd love to say hello to her while you're doing that. We're going to try to keep her up as late as she can for one more night. I want to thank Blue Stockings Books again, and thank you all for coming out.